and I still can't believe it. I look at the book cover and I see the three awards and I think, oh, who wrote that? Oh, that's my name on there. I can't even think of it.
That's Minnesota author Amy Pendino. Her new debut novel has received three writing awards already. It's a mystery set in the farmlands of Iowa. It's called The Witness Tree. It's what we're reading. Thanks for tuning in to What We're Reading. It's our show all about books. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Today we're going to hear about one of the most interesting historical figures you probably haven't heard of, Eugene Bullard, the world's first African-American fighter pilot and legend extraordinaire. Author Tom Clavin will tell us more about it. All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard, is his new book. We'll hear more from up-and-coming Minnesota writer Amy Pendino. Her debut novel is a mystery set in the farmlands of Iowa. It's called The Witness Tree. We'll get a list of top three books from one of our community members. Jordan Scheer from Bemidji will tell us about his favorite coming-of-age books. Critically acclaimed writer Dave Eggers has a new book out. It's a scathing satire on contemporary American politics, The Captain and the Glory. We'll hear from Dave later in the show. And finally, it is the gift-giving season, so we'll hear your stories about getting or giving books as gifts. Stay tuned. Two world wars, the jazz age, the civil rights movement, and one exceptional man who connects them all. Tom Clavin is the author of 18 books. He's written for newspapers and magazines. He's been a TV and radio commentator. Tom and fellow author Phil Keith have just co-written an exciting new biography on one of the most interesting historical figures you've never heard of, Eugene Bullard, the world's first African-American fighter and legend extraordinaire. The book is called All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard, Boxer, Pilot, Soldier, Spy. And Tom joins us now to tell us more about this fascinating person. So Tom, the title, Boxer, Pilot, Soldier, Spy, had kind of a Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy vibe? Is that intentional?
It was. We wanted the title. We knew the main title would be All Blood Runs Red, which is also what Eugene Bullard had stenciled on the fuselage of his plane when he was a fighter pilot. But with the part afterwards, we were saying, how can we possibly hint at all the different lives that he had? So we chose just those four, and inevitably, yes, I mean, it had that John le Carré thing to it, that Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and we figured, well, since that did so well, the association can't hurt.
Tell us how you first heard about Eugene Bullard, and what about him inspired you and your co-author to write a book on him?
Well, initially, it was Phil Keith and I have been friends for years, and we have a mutual friend who's a newspaper editor, and somehow he came across the name of Eugene Bullard, and as a fighter pilot, a generation before the Tuskegee Airmen. And right about the same time, Phil was working on his own book that dealt with World War One, and he saw this footnote that referred to a Eugene Bullard, who was the first African American fighter pilot. So we were having a discussion about it, and we said, gosh, just on that alone, it sounds interesting. We had no idea, as we started to do some initial research, wasn't sure if we were going to do a book, but we said, let's look into it. As we started to do some more research and find out that he was not only the first African-American fighter pilot, but he was a welterweight boxing contender who trained with Jack Johnson. He was he served in two world wars. He was a spy for the French resistance during World War II. He was a nightclub impresario in Paris in the 1920s. all these other lives he had packed into one lifetime that we felt compelled. We said, you know, we can't believe that somebody has not already done a book on this guy, and let's go for it.
I can't get over Eugene Bullard's resume that you laid out for us in this book. Fighter pilot, jockey, carnival worker, boxer, jazz musician, elevator operator. I'm so impressed with how much he's done in his life.
He was born in Georgia, and he and his family, which was not atypical at the time, were subjected to a lot of racism and violence, and he actually ran away from home and eventually made his way, stowed away on a ship that was crossing the Atlantic, eventually made his way to Europe and to England. And he had, you know, a couple of dollars in his pocket, and one of the things he did was he worked as a street musician, minstrel show, carnival worker. He would poke his head out of this circle, and people would throw like these rubber balls at it as an attraction. And he and the operator of the attraction made a lot of money because it was so unique to have a black face come out of this opening. You know, people were not used to that. This is in 1914, 1915, 1913. So he did whatever needed to be done to make a few dollars and get himself to the next stop along the way, because his ultimate goal was to go to France, because he had been told by his father that in France people don't treat you because of the color of your skin. They treat everybody equal. That was a bit of an exaggeration, but that was something that was a goal in his mind. Let me get to France and see what it's like to live in a country that doesn't have racism.
Eventually, Eugene got into some civil rights activism. Can you tell us about his work in that?
He did. It was accidental. You know, years later, after he had come back, he had returned. It took quite a few years before he came back to the United States. And when he did, he was living in Harlem, and his daughters had grown up. And there was an entertainer at the time called Paul Robeson, who was putting on a concert in Peekskill, New York. And Robeson was, to some people, a divisive figure because he openly expressed admiration for communism. This is in the late 1940s, thinking that was a better system. He was also thought it was less racist. He's putting on this concert, and Eugene Bullard and several buses full of people from Harlem came up there to attend the concert. And as they came out of the buses to go into the arena, they were set upon by white nationalists and others, the Ku Klux Klan units, even certain units of police, and they were being beaten. And we have a photograph in the book of Eugene Bullard actually on the ground after being beaten to the ground by people wielding these nightsticks. And he was severely injured, but he stood up, and as bloody as he was, he made his way to that arena, and people saw that and followed him into the arena, and the concert was held. And he started to get notoriety as, you know, he did that for civil. He didn't intend to be a civil rights pioneer, but, you know, he was somebody who would never just you know, lie down, and if he was faced with a challenge, he tried to overcome it.
We're talking with Tom Clavin, and this is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Tom and writer Phil Keith are the co-authors of an exciting new biography, All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard. Tell me about the research and writing process when you're collaborating with another writer on a book. Was there anything difficult about it?
No, it was a pretty smooth process. And if you talk to five different, you know, collaborators on a book, they'll probably give you five different ways that they did it. In our case, Phil started the research, and then I got into the research. He wrote the first draft of the book. I wrote the second and third draft of the book. So it wasn't a kind of thing. You know, some people I know, I don't work that way, but some people, when they collaborate, they'll trade chapters, for example. Or one writer will write one section of three or four chapters, and another writer. I can't do that because I don't think that if you have basically four hands on a keyboard, it's going to work for the reader. They're going to keep seeing or, you know, sensing a different voice with every chapter or every section. So we found it better that Phil write a first draft and I write a complete second draft that was more revising than writing. And basically our voices, so to speak, kind of blended. And so I think from the reaction we've gotten so far, the way the book reads, you can't really tell where one writer begins and the other one ends.
What was one of your favorite things that you discovered about or that you learned about Eugene Bullard during this process?
Well, I think it was fascinating to me that he was the, you know, he had fought both as an infantryman and a pilot in World War One. He came back to Paris. He taught himself basically how to be a jazz musician so he could start getting jobs in the nightclubs there during the 1920s. And he eventually himself operated nightclubs, became this impresario. And he became the friends of many of these expatriate Americans who were coming over to Paris in the 1920s. Became friends of his, Ernest Hemingway, Zelda Scott Fitzgerald, Josephine Baker, Cole Porter, Picasso, the artist community, Picasso, Man Ray, some of the others. And he was a very charismatic person, and so people gravitated to him, and they would have these all-night, you know, extravaganzas that he would preside over. And this became something. Louis Armstrong became a lifelong friend. He later worked for Louis Armstrong as a studio musician and a tour manager. So he was just somebody that people gravitated to, and I found that fascinating.
How do amazing people like Eugene Bullard fall through the cracks of history?
You know, that's a good question, because one answer is that most of his exploits, being the war hero, the nightclub impresario, the boxer, the spy, occurred in Europe between, say, 1914 and the end of World War II. And there really was very little that was being reported back in the United States about his exploits. Another part of it was because he was an African-American, and you know, for example, he was not allowed to fly with the American pilots when they entered World War I. He was not allowed to join the American military. There was just very little coverage of what was happening in the African-American community that existed in France in the 1920s and 30s. So he really, you know, came back to the United States as kind of an unknown figure, even though he'd had this illustrious career and won over a dozen medals for heroism in Europe.
Tom Clavin and Phil Keith are the authors of All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard. A tree in rural Iowa bears witness to generations of human experience and deadly secrets. This same tree seemingly holds a curse. Unexplainable things happen to people who try to remove the tree. Amy Pendino's debut novel is The Witness Tree. It's the story of two women generations apart and the mystery behind how each are connected to this tree and its curse. She taught middle school English for many years, but now she's traded the classroom for horses and pastures and writing full time. Amy joins us now to talk about her new book, The Witness Tree. The Witness Tree features two main characters. There's Lily Bradstreet, a young woman who in 1939 is 18 and excited to leave the small town of Crestview to head to college. And then Danny Holden, who in 2002 is a woman looking to move on from her past. She moves to Crestview to try her hand at farming. Can you tell us more about these two women and what ties them together?
Yes, they both arrive at the small town in different ways. When Danny comes, it's just after 9/11. And she's had a series of events that have kind of forced her to move on and away from the life that wasn't so fulfilling for her in the Twin Cities. She comes down to a small farm she leases in Crestview. And one of the first things she notices is that there's a big, huge tree in one of her neighbor's pastures. And she finds out, and it's hard for her to do so because she's not a local person, she's a newcomer, she finds out that that tree supposedly has a curse. And no one wants to say much more about that. One of the powerful men in town, Jacob Dorn, because he can't find anyone else, else asks Danny to help cut down that tree, and because she wants to fit in, Danny does so. But then weird things start happening, and Danny becomes really curious about what's going on. Accidents are happening to the people that helped to cut down that tree, and this information leads her back to a former resident, and that's Lily Bradstreet. And she lived there, was born in the small town, and in her time was also kind of a renegade. She didn't feel like she fit into her town. She wanted to explore the world. And her time there in Crestview is tied to the curse of that tree.
I learned from your book that a witness tree is an actual thing, like a landmark for farm property lines. How did this become part of your story?
Sure. I found through my research that in times before GPS, so a long time ago, farmers used to use a tree between two differently owned plots of land as a guide to keep their machinery and their crops on their own property. So the witness tree actually witnessed that boundary. And of course, being an English teacher and an English major, I liked the double meaning of witness because of what happened at that tree.
I thought you did a really good job at bringing the Iowa farm country alive. The rows of cornfield, the long dirt roads, how sound carries across the fields, and how you can see weather coming from miles away. So tell me more about like what the setting meant to the story and why you chose to set it
sure.
in Iowa.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I've never lived in Iowa, but a good dear friend of mine moved to Iowa, and she had the land on which that actual tree grew. And I went down to visit her about, it's going to be almost 8 years ago, and I asked her about that tree, and she's the one that told me, oh, I was told when I bought the property, I can't cut this tree down or a curse will happen. I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, I don't know. So that's where I made up the story. That's where that comes from. But as a younger woman, I grew up in a really small town that has since grown quite a bit, and I lived out in the flat. I know there were lakes around, but I just spent hours, as kids did back in the 60s and 70s, exploring the flatland and exploring the hills around me. And I've always been into nature. And I think that really came through in certain parts.
Now, I think it's important to ask you if you believe in curses.
You know, I think there are things we cannot explain, but that doesn't mean that they're not true. And I thought while writing this, that would be the most difficult part. And at the end, I'm not entirely satisfied with how I describe that particular curse. But I think that people can influence events, feelings certainly, and definitely perspectives based on their attitudes. And I think if someone believes something, they're going to see it that way, whether it's real or not.
This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. And I'm talking with Minnesota writer Amy Pendino about her new novel, The Witness Tree. The Witness Tree is a suspense novel. It's a mystery, but it's also about people speaking out for themselves. Danny, as we mentioned earlier, wants to be treated as a peer among farmers mm-hmm. in town. Lily mm-hmm. finds it hard to make others understand why she wants to leave the town mm-hmm. for college. Is this need to speak out something that you drew on your own life stories for?
I think so. When I was younger, I was encouraged to be a leader, and I found myself speaking up sometimes when the room became silent and no one else would talk. And that led into different events through my life where I just feel compelled to speak out. It's like the spirit in me says, you can't keep silent. And although I think mostly that's happened for good, sometimes I think other people have misunderstood my need to address something I feel is unjust or not right. And I think that part comes through in the novel, particularly as it concerns the migrant workers that come through during Lily's time. And in speaking around the state in the past year, I've heard and learned a lot about different communities, both big and small, feelings about migrant workers and how we view people who don't stay for too long. And I think, I hope, that that was presented in a way that the reader can decide for herself or himself, you know, hey, this is something that we need to think about even today.
Now, Amy, this is your debut work, your first published work of fiction, and it's already won some notable awards, the Ben Franklin IBPA Award, the Midwest Book Award, and the IPPI Award. How do you feel about having your first published work win these awards and get this kind of attention and distinction?
Honestly, I think it's a huge honor, and I still can't believe it. I look at the book cover and I see the three awards and I think, oh, who wrote that? Oh, that's my name on there. I can't even think of it. I have written other novels, two other novels, but they were so stinky that they're hidden far away and my sister has been told what to do with them upon my death. So I've had practice. I've written since I've been young. I used to, when I was a young mom, publish poetry. I guess in writing The Witness Tree, my intention was to write for those book club readers who like to know and talk about things that are new and different for them. So as I wrote, and it took 6 years to write The Witness Tree, I thought about that reader in my mind, and that was my audience, and I never intended to do any awards. That was just a fabulous benefit.
I read on your webpage that you are writing full-time now instead of having to work and then write after work. What does that do for your writing process and output?
It's been really fun. Before I retired, I would get up at 5 every morning and write. And then I would go to school. And then after school, we live on a small horse farm, so I would be out in the barn. And especially in the springtime, sometimes overnight when we had mom horses having their foals, I've been off work for 3 months, and it feels right now like I'm finally getting into a routine. My goal is to write 1,000 words a day, and I usually do that in the morning. I usually do it looking out over the back pasture, and that's kind of cool because the follow-up book to The Witness Tree has horses in it, so that's fun to look at them. Back when I wrote The Witness Tree, I did a lot of that writing outside during the summer as well.
It says in your biography that you're a member of the Sisters in Crime group, and mm-hmm. I really need to know what this is.
It's an awesome Twin Cities subsidiary, I guess you would call it, of a national group. And Sisters in Crime was developed to highlight women mystery and crime and thriller writers. We meet every month, and usually there's a featured speaker from the community or outstate, and they give details that would make our writing come to life. We've had forensic examiners. We've had FBI agents. We've had people who have worked in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Last month, for example, we had all women law enforcement, and that went from state troopers, county sheriff, to police women, both here and we had a woman speak who served in Los Angeles for 5 years. So the idea is to, first of all, provide a sisterhood, and secondly, to give us accurate details. I will say, though, we do invite brothers to come as well. They are allowed.
Amy Pendino is a Minnesota writer. The Witness Tree is her debut novel. This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
Somehow, some way, it's But that is one of the reasons why I do love to just still go into a brick and mortar bookstore, is to just kind of get lost in the shelves. And, you know, maybe you come out an hour later and maybe you found nothing new, but maybe you ended up just coming across a book that would stay with you for the rest of your life.
That's Jordan Scheer. He's a reporter with the Bemidji Pioneer and a fellow book lover. And today he's going to talk about coming of age stories. We're going to hear about three of his favorite ones.
The first one is A Walk Across America by Peter Jenkins. The book starts, and he is just in college at the moment. A couple things fall apart, and he and his girlfriend end up breaking up. And after college, he's kind of in the slump. He doesn't know what to do with his life. He's just kind of in this post-college blues, if you will. And he gets it in his head that he's going to walk across America, because he had grown up in suburban Connecticut, if I remember correctly, and had been used to a very certain kind of life. You know, everybody drove to work in their suits and ties and had these big expensive houses. And through a conversation at the school where he was going to, you know, kind of got it knocked into his head that that isn't the way that the rest of America necessarily lives their lives. So he decided that he wanted to go out and see this America that he knew nothing about. Through the course of the book, he just meets the most extraordinary people out there. He meets this little old wrinkled mountain man, you know, who's living on a cabin at the top of the mountains in Appalachia, who is basically cut off from all society. The old man's name is Homer. And that's a perspective on the world that so very few of us get to have. And then, you know, he keeps going south and he ends up in Murphy, North Carolina, I think it is, and comes across this African-American family. And he ends up in this little town of Murphy that's, for all intents and purposes, a segregated community. And, you know, remember, this is back in the 1970s when racial tensions were still a very serious thing, especially down in the South. And so while, you know, while he could have gone to somewhere that was more comfortable for what he grew up with, he chose to live with this, you know, this mother and, or this African-American family of this mother who had like three teenage sons. And, you know, for him at the time, you know, that was an experience that few people in his circumstances would have had. And he lived on a commune, and he did this, and he did that. So in spite of those flaws, just the fact that he's able to sort of tell this grand story of all these unique characters he meets really makes it a hard-to-put-down story as far as I'm concerned. The second book I brought in is The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer, and it's his memoir of growing up in New York City and the bar where his uncle worked. The whole thing is just sort of this beautiful memoir of this young guy growing up in New York City and then going off to college. One of the parts that I really love about The Tender Bar is the writer's relationship with his mom. So through the course of the story, he's living with his mom in New York, and she is struggling to keep the boat above the surface. And there are times when they have to live with his grandparents. There's a time when they move down south and then move back to New York. And he goes through a lot of ups and downs, you know, as we all do. But the relationship that he has with his mom, I think, is really beautiful. And as someone who also has a close relationship with my mom, that was something I really related to, because his mom is someone who obviously cares for him and worries about him. And while it may not be as evident, you know, you pick up through the book that he also not only cares, but also worries about her. And so it's this really great dynamic. One of the moments in the book is that he goes to college and graduates. His mom was incredibly proud of that. And one of the things that she really wanted him to do was she wanted him to get the class ring. For her, that was a way to really commemorate, you know, this achievement that he had gone through. And he was less excited about that. He just didn't care about that sort of, you know, physical memento as much as his mom did. But there comes this moment where they're sitting down to eat, and she's like, "I thought you were going to buy that ring." And he takes out this ring box and he gives it to her. And he's like, "Well, I actually bought this college ring for you." And he tells her, "For as much as this is my moment, it's just as much your moment, because you were there for me every step along the way. And me graduating college is just as much as your victory as it is mine." So I thought that was a really beautiful moment from the book.
This is What We're Reading, and we're listening to Jordan Scheer from Bemidji. He's been telling us about his favorite coming-of-age stories. So far, we've heard about A Walk Across America by Peter Jenkins and The Tender Bar by J.R. Mooring. Next, we'll hear about book number 3 on Jordan's list, and he'll tell us what he thinks connects these books together.
The third book that I brought in is Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Rifka Brunt. And it's, unlike the first two, it's a novel. This young teenager, I think she's 14, and her uncle dies of AIDS back in the 1980s. And the uncle dies fairly early in the book. Through the course of like cleaning out her uncle's belongings and whatnot, she comes across a note basically kind of directing her to her uncle's partner of a number of years and whatnot. And she comes to learn a lot about her uncle through his partner, who, as you know, go on to find out, is also sick and in the process of dying. And so growing up, she thought she knew her uncle. You know, of course she knew her uncle. They spent all this time together. But through the course of meeting and spending time with his partner of many years, she learns this whole other side of him. And in the course of all this, she's also dealing with her mom, who was very, remember this back in the 1980s, right. The mother was very unaccepting of the partner and to some extent her brother, the uncle. And so through the course of this book, the girl, her name is June, just comes to learn about her uncle in a new way and learn about her mom and all these sort of undertones between her mom and her uncle. And at the end of the book, you learn that the mom comes to maybe not a complete acceptance, mm-hmm. but comes to understand her brother a little bit better. You know, while The Tender Bar also does deal with family elements, I think that Tell the Wolves I'm Home more so is a story about family. It's a story about overcoming obstacles to embrace your family for who they are rather than who you think they should be. One of the things that they all have in common, and one of the reasons why I like to read these stories, is in one way or another, they are all very much coming-of-age stories. They all, you know, are dealing with younger people who are trying to find their way in the world and go about that in different ways. There's all sorts of valuable stories out there, but I think coming-of-age stories are such an important kind of story because that's how we grow, that's how we learn, that's how, you know, when you can capture those sort of large milestone learning opportunities and, you know, give them to a reader, I think that's just a really valuable and beautiful thing to be able to give someone in, you know, a few hundred pages. So they are all very good stories about different kinds of journeys. Your heart's got-